Hello one and all, and welcome back to season 4 of Vegan World. Wherever you download the show, whether it's North America, South America, mainland Europe, Australia or New Zealand or Japan, wherever that happens to be, thank you for taking the time to download it, and I really appreciate it. Now, first up in season 4 we have Julia Gilladley. She's the founder of animal rights organisation Viva in the UK. Now today I talked to Juliet about her background, how she first became aware of animal rights and decided to get involved in them, and also not only that but dedicate her life to the cause of ending animal suffering. But before we get started today, I wanted to draw your attention to an expert virtual roundtable that takes place on April 15th, 2 p.m. UK time, that's 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific. And you can register now for that on www.viva.org.uk. The topic is a ban on UK factory farming, what that might look like and how this can be achieved, as well as the benefits it'll bring us, our health, the environment and of course the animals. In the meantime, on with today's show. Hello and welcome to Vegan World, Julia Gilladley.
Hello, thanks for inviting me on.
Julia, for those who maybe haven't heard of Viva and of yourself, because a lot of our listeners are based in the US and Canada and all around the world. Before we come on to talk about Viva and the work that you are currently engaged in and have been engaged on in the past, tell me a bit about yourself and how you first became interested in animal rights and going vegan.
Well, that takes me right back to childhood. My mum used to say that I used to fight for the underdog. That was her expression about me, whoever that underdog happened to be. And obviously those who don't have a voice at all, of course, are animals. So I got very passionate about defending animals when I was young. And I'd say I started getting leaflets, etc., through when I was probably about 10, 11 years old, and started searching for information. Of course, this was pre everyone having computers at home. So, and Google didn't even exist. It wasn't created. So, it was literally getting paper through, and I got a leaflet about factory farming, and I had been brought up as eating everything, meat, fish, dairy, the lot, and didn't question it, to be quite honest. And when I saw that, I was absolutely horrified and spoke to my family, and they kind of made sort of sympathetic noises, but did not encourage me to go any further with it. And being the bolshy so-and-so that I was probably a right pain in the ass, actually. I decided that I was going to see factory farming for myself, thinking it would be a lot easier than it actually is, of course. But in fact, managed to do it in the end through going to what was a so-called showplace for worldwide farmers in the Midlands in the UK. And it was a huge place. I went with an agricultural student, actually. So for the pig unit, we were actually shown round officially, just the two of us. And you know, you had this guy talking about all the economics of it, and all I could see were these hundreds of pigs who were in these tiny, what were called sow stalls then, where they could barely move and they were all pregnant. And I walked down this aisle and obviously was very shocked. They were just in these industrialized concrete units, and there were four boars. I always remember this really distinctly because the animals were so much bigger than I ever imagined, about the size of Shetland ponies. And one of them had a lame leg and he was salivating and just looked in a bad way. And he limped, well, literally dragged himself actually towards me, looked me right in the eye. And I can remember very vividly just saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And looking around this agricultural unit, all these animals just imprisoned that could barely move. And thought, no, I'm not going to be part of this anymore. And of course that was, you know, a huge life-changing moment for me, and really was the start of Viva, although of course I did not know that then. Because I was a very passionate teenager and I felt very strongly about animals, and I was absolutely convinced that nobody would want cruelty to animals, and what happens in farms is so extreme, and in vivisection labs is so extreme. All I had to do was tell people what was going on, wake them up, and of course the whole world would change and it would be that simple. I had that optimism of youth. I really, really did. And so I'd set myself on a course to actually save animals, and part of that was saving the world as far as I was concerned, and literally chose my A-levels to go down that route. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I thought at university I should study zoology. because somehow I'm going to be able to use that if I can show that I understand the animal kingdom. And in fact, that is what I did.
You touched on something there, Juliet. I think here in the UK, we view ourselves as a nation of animal lovers, but we're blissfully unaware of what actually goes on behind those closed doors and how animals are treated. Those agricultural shows, as far as I'm aware, we have them here where I'm based in Northern Ireland as well, and they always like to put on a certain front, a certain image for the public, you know, where they'll groom their livestock every year and they have their best in show, you know, cows and bulls and everything on there. And it kind of angers me in a little way when I look and I see that, because it's obviously not the real story of what goes on behind it. And that's what you've actually used in a really positive way to actually start an animal rights charity.
Yes, I did. But you're right. We are conned at every level. It's a really interesting, you know, when you know the truth, because obviously I personally investigated so many so-called mega farms now. So you're talking about the big guys, you know, not some aberrant little farm. You're talking about mainstream farming, and it's so cool when we show the British public what's going on. So we've done things like we've made films with 360 degree cameras, or just what, a 3D camera. So people are wearing the goggles and they're immersed into it, and they find it very tough going. And this is people from every walk of life, you know, literally every background. And people are much more prepared to watch this kind of stuff now. But the most common thing that they say, apart from the fact that they can't believe it's happening, is that they thought the standards in Britain were the best in the world, and they don't understand how this is legal. And so you're really opening people's eyes to this, despite the fact that all these investigations have gone out on social media. People still largely really don't know what is going on. And then you have schemes like Red Tractor, and of course you've heard about, which is a marketing scheme in the UK. It's a labeling scheme. So this little cute red tractor, which is obviously chosen to, you know, hit on people's nostalgia from, you know, from being little kids. They love driving tractors, and they stamp things with this little red tractor on products like, you know, meat. And the implication is, well, not they actually advertise, there's a massive television advertising campaign, so a lot of money put behind it right at the moment, where they say things like farmed with care, that products that you choose stamped with them are safe, that the cows have a personal vet. I mean, it is sickening, you know, that if you choose from them, that they have, yeah, the second ad, which is a cartoon one, we have rigorous standards for animal welfare, for protecting the environment. And in fact, just about every farm we have exposed in the last several years, all of them have been Red Tractor approved. And honestly, the conditions in those places, you would cry. Even the hardest people cry, because you just cannot believe people can be so callous.
Yeah, I've seen that ad, actually, the one you talked about. And I know on viva.org.uk, you've got the reference to it there in terms of the mutilations that go on. And I think people see the red tractor, like you say, and they think, okay, I feel better about my choice here, you know, but it's just a complete lie, you know, about what goes on behind there. But if we take a little bit step back, Julia, to what you were saying before about when you first went vegan, when you first became interested in animal rights, obviously because, you know, as you said yourself, you favored the underdog. When you actually made that decision and decided to go down that path and change your life, how did this impact you in your day-to-day life with friends and family at that time?
At first, obviously the people closest to you and the one largely responsible for cooking still tends to be mum. And she always liked animals, as she would put it, and, you know, typically loved dogs especially, actually, but wildlife as well. So there was an in, I suppose, with her, in that there was some empathy already. She hated me talking about the cruelty to animals and would try and cut me off when I tried to describe stuff to her and got hold of videos, the old-fashioned VHS videos, if anybody remembers what the hell they are. I used to try and actually sit her down and make her watch this stuff. And she, at first, although there was some empathy with it, I don't think she really believed me that it was as bad as it was. At this stage, I hadn't gone round the factory farms for myself. I was just trying to describe it from a leaflet. So she probably thought the organisations were exaggerating. when I made the choice initially to go vegetarian, she was a bit worried by it, to be honest. She thought I was going to kind of wither away because she'd never thought about it. And I can remember she made rice dishes where she would chop up the chicken really small into tiny cubes, because she was that convinced that I needed to eat it. And of course, I would discover it and say to her, look, if you do this again, I'm not eating anything you actually make. And, you know, we're kind of got to start again with this, Mom. You have to understand that I really am serious. She thought it would be a fad like many parents do with a teenager. And of course, it wasn't. It was the beginning of something very big for me. When I actually went round the factory farm as a young teenager and could describe it personally, she then really took me seriously and, you know, knew I was telling the truth. You know, it was very obvious that I was just describing what I had actually seen. And she had huge sympathy for it and gave up all meat herself at that point. My brother and sister both went vegetarian almost immediately, kind of overnight, which was really gratifying. And the one who held back was... I'm sorry to be so stereotyped with my family, but it was my dad.
Isn't it always?
He took literally about 2 decades to change. And in fact, when I went home when I was a university student, he would say, oh, God, I bet you're really missing meat, and sort of try and, you know, take the mickey out of it and all the rest of it rather than understand it. And I just let it, you know, I just let it go in one ear out the other. I did not rise to the so-called bait. I used a big sense of humour with him. And I remember, and also his love of animals, because fundamentally he did like to think he loved animals. Nobody really wants to say that they're cruel. And I remember, you know, years later, I was in Brighton where I'd moved, and we were just out for a walk, and he said, that's it, I'm going vegetarian, Juliet. Just from absolutely nowhere. We hadn't even been talking about it. And I sort of almost, you know, dropped dead with the shock, to be honest, because he'd given no indication at all. So he's kind of proof that literally anybody can change. But as you well know, sometimes family can be the hardest to persuade, can't they?
They can be.
Change strangers.
Yeah, and equally, as you said before, the most encouraging ones behind you at the same time, depending on who in your family you're talking about, obviously. I know exactly where you're coming from. So then came Viva. The challenges that you must have experienced in the early years, Julia, what did that look like in terms of actually getting an organization like that together and getting it off the ground and promoting it?
Well, in my 20s, I'd spent a long time building up the campaigns and youth education campaigns for the Vegetarian Society of the UK, which they'd never done before, believe it or not, even though they were a very old organization. So I'd sort of cut my teeth building something almost from scratch, with relatively little help and low budgets. And when I left to set up Viva, I had that kind of experience, but also really importantly, the contacts. So I built up a reputation as a campaigner and I'd had got a hell of a lot of publicity. So that's really important in terms of, you know, getting those contacts, especially if you haven't got money. So unfortunately, you know, I wasn't rich. I couldn't self-fund this new charity. So I had to rely on somebody else doing that. And at the beginning, obviously, just the fact, the logistical stuff, the boring stuff like getting computers and a franking machine and a photocopy, you know, they've all got to come from somewhere. So fortunately, there was a lady called Audrey Eiton who had watched my work previously and funded some of it, and she liked it. And she always said, I remember her saying publicly, which was very kind of her, I don't fund an organization, I fund the person, because it's people that matter. And I've been watching you. And I presented a 5-year business plan for Viva to her, and she gave the first donation, which was in 1994, which was then £20,000, which is like today the equivalent of giving somebody £40,000 with no guarantee of getting a penny of it back. There were no strings attached, and you know, it was an organization that didn't exist. So it was a lot of faith in me, and that paid for sort of all the fundamentals of getting Viva going. We had, you know, literally a couple of part-time staff, that was it. So I was doing everything myself. I was receptionist through to campaigner, through to PR officer, marketing person, merchandise manager, physically sending merchandise out, choosing the stock, literally everything. So I wouldn't underestimate how hard it is setting up an organization that if you take seriously as being a national organization from the get-go, which I did, But I was very, very pragmatic. I decided if it didn't, you know, go where I wanted it to and wasn't a serious national organisation very quickly, I would let it go. I wasn't going to hold on to something for the sake of it just because it was me. But it did. It grew really very, very quickly indeed.
Well, get it off the ground. Not only did you do that, but you got it to where it is today, where it's grown, it's thriving, not just surviving. And when anybody looks on your website, viva.org.uk, there's the four main, I guess, tenets of the organization and the promotion, the message that you put across, which is animals, planet, health, and lifestyle. Just talk me quickly through those, Julia. What's okay, behind that?
So that's right. So Viva has those four sections, if you like, four slices. I suppose the biggest one and the one we're most well known for, it won't surprise you, is animals, because fundamentally, you know, in my heart, that is what drove me to set up Viva. I wanted to be a loud campaigning voice for the animals first and foremost, because nobody was doing it back then. So we were at the forefront of doing investigations. Obviously, times have changed and other organisations are doing that as well. But back then it was quite, you know, a unique thing to be doing, going into the actual factory farms and slaughterhouses and filming what you saw in front of you and reporting on that and getting that in the media. We were very good at getting national media coverage, sometimes international media coverage. And so that was one of our raison d'etre, and sort of trying to educate people as to why we really should not be doing this to animals, and why it's one of the main reasons why, in fact, the Earth, you know, the whole planet Earth is collapsing around us. So that is one of the things. But as you said, the other three arms are planet. So as many people know now, the main driver of the sixth mass extinction, so wildlife literally going extinct while we're here under our tenure, is due to actually animal agriculture. So consuming meat, fish and dairy is the main driver of loss of wildlife species. So it's explaining to people why that is the case. It's also a main driver for the climate crisis as well. So the other part of the planet is we look at how we should be transitioning, and that's something that we're moving more and more into, which is to persuade industry and governments, obviously it's the consumer we work with the most, that without transitioning to what's called stock-free or veganic farming, then really we are doomed as a species. We actually have to start making that transition very quickly. And those countries who lack food security are going to be in severe trouble within a decade if they don't start transitioning very, very soon indeed. So major issues that we're looking at there, things like use of water as well. And then there's the health issues, which we've worked on for many, many years. And I am, you know, very proud of the health and nutrition section, because we literally look at reputable studies that are published worldwide in reputable journals, and we enable access to the layperson to understand why animal products are destroying our health and why we thrive, in fact, on a vegan diet. There's been a lot of work we've done on that over the years, because you can imagine when we started, people were not convinced by what I've just said at all. They were convinced that the meat and two veg was the way to go, and without meat and dairy and fish that you would, you know, wither away on the vine. And of course, we had a lot of work to do in convincing, and things have changed so very much. So where we have, you know, sports icons, it really helps when you've got people like Lewis Hamilton, who's such a staunch vegan and such a male role model, you know, out there, and many more like him now, which we didn't have at the beginning. So sort of proof is in the pudding and all the rest of it. And then the final section is lifestyle, as you said. So that's helping people change. So Viva was the first organisation, believe it not, in the UK to do the vegan festivals. Now, of course, everybody's doing them. But that was all about helping people change. Back then we didn't charge anything for entry. About a third of the entrants would be meat eaters. So we were giving away free food, which of course is not done in festivals today, because most of the stalls are paid for food stalls where people are paying for food. But back then we were literally giving away vegan food from all the main national, international cuisines, and loads of food samples, just trying to help people change. And as you'll see from the website, there's just masses of information on alternatives to dairy, alternatives to meat, alternatives to fish. And we run the Vegan Recipe Club, which is huge and one of the most popular things we do in helping people change, because there are very many hundreds and hundreds of recipes on there, which are all very easy to search on. So if you want very quick recipes or for a certain occasion, you can find them very quickly. I'm going to stop there because I could go on and on and on about Viva.
It's good that there is that there, because one of the main things when I talk to people, wherever they're from, you know, and, you know, some people can push back a little on some of those things, you know, until you lead them to their own natural conclusion, you know, whether it's, you find out what people's in is, you know, for want of a better way of putting it, whether it's animals, their own health, environment, whatever that happens to be. But you touched on something there, Juliet, with regards to going previously when you guys were going into factory farms and the reporting. I know that Viva has been instrumental in putting out the message about Hogwood Farm. That's one of the main things on your website, that if you could talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes, we started, we had an investigation of a so-called mega farm. So that means they're particularly large, basically, as you'd imagine, for the UK. So this farm had the capacity, it had about 16,000 pigs at the time. And we sent out an investigator because we'd had complaints locally. So it's in the middle of England, near Stratford-upon-Avon, Shakespeare country. And the investigator was very experienced, but he was particularly shocked by this place. So I decided to launch a full investigation and go myself and do what we'd called a face-off, which is where I was filming to camera and having to describe what I was seeing. And I found it really very difficult indeed, actually. And again, I've done many investigations myself over the years, but the state of some of these animals was just heartbreaking. And I remember this was 2017. We just rescued Hope. We named this sow Hope. She'd had her fifth pregnancy, where all her babies had been taken away, and she was just in this small concrete pen, I guess you'd call it. And she had six babies, and the pig farm was closing down. So we'd rescued Hope and her six piglets, done this naming competition to involve people as much as possible. But what it meant for me was that I was going to this sanctuary where I was really involved with seeing piglets from 3.5 weeks grow up and see how mind-blowingly intelligent and communicative these animals are. As a zoologist, I'd read about this stuff because obviously I was very interested, but it's very, very different. As everybody knows who's got experience with cats and dogs, it's totally different reading about them and experiencing what it's like to share your life with these animals. And so it's a massive eye-opener for me. So going around Hogwood when we'd just rescued these pigs and knowing how bright these animals are, you know, firsthand, and seeing animals that were lying on the floor that had had ulcers that had been clearly there for weeks, that had gone black and necrotic with the death of the tissue right through to the bone. And God knows what pain animals like that were in, with other pigs sort of like nipping at the flesh around the edges and another one thrashing in her last death throes. And so on and so forth. It was just dreadful. I mean, it was wretched. And other places where I walked in, where I remember the first shed I walked into, there was hundreds of animals. It was an old-fashioned unit, that in the sense that they just literally had hundreds of animals together with no corridor to walk through them. So they all kind of crowded towards me, no doubt as something that was, you know, of interest to them, because you have to remember these are very bright, intelligent animals who've got absolutely nothing whatsoever to do. And I think as human beings, we dismiss that. But think about it. Think about, you know, yourself as a child, or if you've got children, imagine trying to keep four-year-olds in a unit which is just made of concrete with absolutely nothing, several hundred of them together, and giving them nothing. Imagine what their behavior would turn into. And it was very, very difficult. And I went from unit to unit. I happened to walk into the mother's unit, where they are still in the UK largely kept in what's called farrowing crates. So they're literally put in metal barred stalls to give birth, and just happened to walk in as one was giving birth. And I, you know, to camera was talking, she gave birth to these poor little mites onto basically, you know, soil-ridden concrete again, just cold, cold, dreadful world that they were being born into. And I can distinctly remember one little male piglet, and he couldn't find his mother's teats. And I remember literally being emotionally torn of whether to help him or actually hope that he died, because dying was a release from what else he was going to have to go through.
Yeah.
And I mean, how ridiculous that we've, you know, and how abhorrent that we've created these places that are so bad that, you know, you go through that kind of emotional turmoil should they die at 1 hour old versus go through what, you know. And outside there's this industrialized sort of like barrow, and I remember lifting the lid off it, and there was all these piglets just with thousands and thousands of maggots writhing around them, and it just somehow epitomized everything that was going on in that farm, that they were just the rubbish. And, you know, even worse, when our investigator went in the first time, all these adults were just laid outside, you know, outside literally in the on the concrete in between the sheds, where all the dead, who were, you know, fully grown, often with blood coming out of their nose for whatever reason. And I have to say, one of the most upsetting sights is, I don't know if you've heard of rectal strictures,
mm-hmm.
which is where in factory farms they're quite common, and they're often due to bacterial infection. So they get a bacterial infection in their gut, and it causes like a blockage in their gut, so that their stomachs start to bloat out and out and out. But if you look at them, you'll see their ribs sticking through and their spine sticking through. So they're literally starving to death, but all these toxins are getting into their system, and they can't absorb anything and they can't poo. So everything's backing up. And of course, these animals should be, you know, put to sleep, should be killed very quickly, because they will not spend the money on veterinary treatment for them, of course, and they always die. And I can remember seeing animals that had just been left in this state to just die very, very, very slowly. And you just think, what kind of people are these that leave animals to suffer so very, very clearly? And Hogwood, anyway, we exposed it. We found out that they supplied Tesco, which is the biggest retailer in the UK. And I thought, actually, it was so bad that Tesco would withdraw and say we're having nothing to do with Hogwood. And in fact, everybody, including Red Tractor, who I talked about before, who approved them, the National Pig Association, the National Farmers Union, the whole industry, the government, and Tesco, all dug their heels in and said, no, we'll work with them to change, but really it's not as bad as you're saying. When we went in and inspected, it wasn't as bad as you're showing on your video footage. You know, it's sort of like, well, how did it get that bad? You know, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. How they responded. And we went back in the following year, 2018, but they'd spent tens and tens and tens of thousands of pounds and make it very difficult to get back in with a lot of security. So that was difficult. I had to call off the investigation because there was an animal cannibalizing another one alive, and called a vet, and we called the police, actually. But nothing had changed in any kind of substantial way. It was just all the same. Again, all these bodies dug their heels in and defended Hogwood. And so we went back again. I was just determined. In the meantime, we were having these days of action with Viva supporters outside all the Tesco stores on the same day. Our Viva supporters were amazing. The British public were amazing. Everybody supported us. Nobody believed Tesco. The publicity for them was incredibly negative, but they still dug their heels in. We went back again, 2019, but this time we left hidden cameras. And because on the hidden cameras, this won't surprise you, the men that were working there were hitting the animals, and Tesco could no longer, they didn't feel that the PR exercise in terms of defending Hogwood was a worthwhile exercise, put it that way. They didn't, you know, withdraw from Hogwood for any ethical reasons, of course. They just couldn't justify what we'd filmed, and so it went in a big splash in a big national paper, and they withdrew literally within hours of that going out. And Cranswick Foods, by the way, who are one of the biggest global sort of pork suppliers, issued a statement saying they would never take meat from Hogwood again. So they were connected to the big boys, is my point, really, and they did all withdraw. But I think the lesson from it is that took us over three years of different investigations, and no matter how bad it was, they didn't care. But they were embarrassed by local people going outside their stores. They really didn't like that. We got people to go in showing the footage to individual managers of Tesco stores, and the managers were often on our side, but the orders had come from on high that they had to continue down this line. And interestingly, the reason I was given from behind the scenes, they haven't said this officially, this was behind the scenes, was because pig farming is so bad in the UK, standards are so low, that if they withdrew from Hogwood, then the next one we would expose would be just as bad, because that's what factory farming is. And it's, they didn't want this kind of domino effect. Basically, these big retailers will sell what people buy. And they are now, of course, committing to selling vegan food, you know, en masse, you know, and they will sell it because that is what the demand is. But equally, they will sell the cheapest factory farmed meat from the worst conditions without a second thought either. And the only time they give it that second thought is when someone like Viva comes along and embarrasses them. And, you know, their customers keep writing to them and making, you know, a nuisance of themselves in Tesco's view, that they keep complaining. And you know, and eventually dogged persistence really works. They thought we'd go away. They really did think we would go away. But
we didn't.
And we made a documentary. Sorry, I'll just finish. But we made a documentary called Hogwood, A Modern Horror Story, which widens out, of course, to not just Hogwood, but to the damage factory farming is doing to the world and how it feeds into pandemics, of course, very topically, with very important experts sort of speaking out. And that's on Amazon Prime, as part of people's Amazon Prime package.
It's fascinating in the sense that Hogwood, I'm sure, as you've touched on, is one in a long line of farms that behave in this way and treat those poor creatures in the way that they do. And it wasn't because of any moral kind of, you know, backtracking on behalf of Tesco's or you know, Sainsbury's, whoever, you know, buys from other pork farms. It's actually when it starts to hit them in the pocket that they start to listen, and they're embarrassed, as you put it, you know, into actually retreating from their position to say, okay, maybe we shouldn't do this. It takes something like that for people to, you know, for these organizations to start to actually listen to what's going on and look at what's going on our farms. But that leads us on to one of the next things I wanted to talk about, Julia, which is the ban on factory farming virtual round table that Viva have coming up quite soon, where the likes of these issues will be discussed. I know you have quite a varied and quite an interesting panel on there. It's on the 15th of April, quite next week.
Yeah,
he said as he looks at his calendar. Talk to us about that. And if anybody from around the world who's listening to this, how can they get involved in that, or how can they hook up with that?
So you can get involved from anywhere, because it's obviously a virtual conference where we have MPs. I'm really pleased that we've got MPs from all the major parties taking part in it. But basically what we did was we got Dr. Lisa Cameron MP tabled an early day motion, which, you know, was written by Viva to ban UK factory farming. And there's going to be a question at Prime Minister's Question Time the day before the actual round table next week, so that'll be really interesting to see how he handles that. But,
I'll be listening for that.
And then on the 15th of April at 2 p.m, if you go to the main Viva website, the homepage, just viva.org.uk, so that's V-I-V-A, viva.org.uk, and you just scroll down a little bit, you'll see the roundtable promoted there, and you just click on that and you can ensure that you get a place to go. There already 500 people have actually booked to go, actually, which is really good. So that's 15th of April at 2 p.m. in the UK anyway. And we have other experts though, which are equally interesting to the politicians, which is we have people like Ian Tolhurst, who's been a stock-free farmer for many years now, because we want to talk about the transition to stock-free farming and how it's possible. And, you know, he's obviously there at the front line doing it. But also there are people like Rebecca, who runs stock-free farming organisation and Viva Scotland. So she works again on the front line with farmers, helping them transition. So at the moment, she's helping an organic farmer transition to stock-free farming, where you're not using any animal products at all. And also we have Kerry Waters, who worked for 4 years on subsidies, actually, at DEFRA. So she's got another take on that, like what the government should be practically doing to ensure, like I said before, we have to have this transition to veganic or stock-free farming, for there to be basically any food security for the UK and every other country in the world needs to take this really seriously, but also to stop climate change. There's absolutely no way that the world can reach its targets without going to vegan farming. And so how do we do that? And what will the picture look like? Because obviously, as you know, but a lot of people don't, by feeding people crops directly, you need vastly less amounts of land and you produce about half the amount of greenhouse gases. So the figures are absolutely staggering. You produce, you know, way less water pollution, for example, as well. So it feeds into many of these issues. But going back to the space, literally the physical space on planet Earth, we have to go to stock-free farming where we're eating the crops directly instead of growing crops to then feed to the billions of animals that people are eating as food. Or grazing them, of course. So everybody's heard about the Amazon rainforest being destroyed for grazing, but it's also largely destroyed for growing crops to feed to factory farm pigs, factory farm chickens, and of course cattle. And it happens to be soya that they're growing. There's nothing wrong particularly with soya. It just happens to be soya is the crop that they have chosen to destroy the rainforest for. So these are huge issues, and even people, you know, the icons like David Attenborough finally saying, yes, people need to stop eating meat. Somebody like him would probably say, I can't remember the exact words he used. I think he said drastically reduce meat consumption. But there's an acknowledgement now from the mainstream environmentalists that this is a very, very important issue. And so we're looking at with this round table is, should the UK be the first country to ban factory farming and what that actually means? So I think it's only an hour. It's, you know, it's not much of your time, but I think it's a really important part of our bigger campaign, which is end factory farming before it ends us. And so if anyone listening to this is interested in banning factory farming, please, you know, come along and join us next week.
Julia, listen, thank you very much for your time today. And I wanted to thank you for the work that you do. Not only is it informative, is it educational, but the exposés that you've done in the past and opening people's eyes to what's actually going on around, not just in the UK, but in the world, and the impact that those decisions that we make have on ourselves and those around us is absolutely fantastic. And the vegan movement is all the stronger for having you in it. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for all your support and helping us get the message out there.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that. I'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with another episode of Vegan World. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, stay happy. Until next time, bye for now.